It is Saturday, December 27th, 2014. We're broadcasting live from Santa Cruz on the central coast of California. This is KOSP Public Radio 88.9 and KOSP.org. It's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP or any of the geeks' affiliated organizations. Good morning and hello. I'm Lyle Troxell, and with me in the studio is Phoenix Taves, digital artist and software engineer. It's the second time on Geek Speak, right, Phoenix?
Yes.
Congratulations and welcome.
Thanks for
I know it's the highlight of your year, right?
Glad to be here again.
Yeah, it's great to have you. So Phoenix actually does a lot of software development, and including mobile devices, and actually does some work on kind of a virtual reality in the real world, which we call augmented reality, where it's kind of some of your art practice. Have you been doing more of that work lately?
A little bit.
Yeah.
Not as much as I would like, but you know, there's doing the art, then there's actually making the money. So, you know, the balance, the work
sometimes
art balance
hard.
Sometimes,
yeah.
You know,
actually,
sometimes it weighs more into the I have to make money than the art, but
yeah. So, one of the things I do commonly on Geek Speak is, or one of the things that commonly is asked of me is recommendations for stuff, right? So someone meets me and they're like, well, what kind of computer should I buy? And then I go into the long discussion of, well, what do you like to do? And what, you know, what are you doing? And then I recommend probably a Chromebook, most likely for most people. And then I recommend maybe a Mac, and then I painfully say, yeah, you probably need to stay on a Windows machine if that's the case. So I do have some judgment there. But one of the things that people ask me are about, like, televisions or any kind of electronics are going to die. And I know diddly about televisions because, in fact, I haven't had a television in my home since, well, in my living room, like, you know, main part of my life, since before I started doing Geek Speak. And I've been doing Geek Speak for 14 years. So basically, I've never had a TV. But this, I now have a television. I have bought a television over this weekend, installed it in the main part of my house. And it's, you know, it's a bit of a change, but I kind of want to suggest, you know, talk about a bit about that. Do you have a television in your main part of your house, Phoenix?
We do have a television, yes.
And is it a flat screen big thing?
It's a flat screen big thing. It was given to us for Christmas a year ago. Otherwise, we wouldn't have a television.
Yeah. Well, one of the things I am is a photographer. I take a lot of photographs and I listen to a lot of podcasts, right? Those are my media forms normally.
Right.
And of course, I work for Netflix, and so I use a tablet most of the time for watching like Netflix movies and things. But what I found is that with the family, I wanted to sit around a couch and watch together. And we couldn't really do that in our house. I was continually like breaking apart my computer in the back room and putting my monitor in the living room to do that. So anyway, I at work saw about a year ago 4K televisions. Do you know what 4K televisions are?
Oh, yes. High density televisions.
Yeah. Ultra
high density.
Yeah.
They call
like
it. They're
a few different marketing names, but basically it's a lot more pixels.
Yes.
On the screen. And the reason I was seeing it at work is that we actually, Netflix has some streaming content that is that quality. And one of them they have is this thing called Flower or something. And it's basically just this beautiful, high quality video of like fields and flowers.
Uh-huh.
And I was stunned with the image quality. And like it was beautiful. And so I kind of got excited about the idea of adding to my photo wall a really big screen that would allow me to show off my photos. And that was my motivation, of course. So what I got was an LG 55-inch 4K television. They're more expensive. They're like double the price of a normal television at the same ratio and all that. But I don't know. So far, I'm really impressed with the quality. Have you seen the 4K screens?
Have you played them? I have seen the 4K screens. They're really nice.
Yeah.
Well, the trade-off, of course, is depending on the screen, is the you may have a really high pixel density, but you may have a slow refresh rate. And
yes.
They've got a problem with that.
That's right, because when you push a lot more data, it takes more time.
By default,
yeah.
And then, of course, you have to have devices that can push that.
Yes.
So,
and in fact, there's not really interfaces that do that. Like see, this is where my lack of expertise in televisions come in. But the HDMI line has to be a secondary quality to get that kind of data. And we don't see devices outputting that, right?
Right.
And right now, the 4K was kind of released last year at CES.
The Macintosh can output that, but you need an adapter for it.
Right.
For those TVs. I don't know.
I haven't plugged in my laptop yet to code, but I know that I'll be cracking down some GeekSpeak code relatively soon on that big screen because it's too tempting not to. In any case, the right now the sources are pretty limited on doing this. Streaming is basically the only way to get this content because it's a higher quality than Blu-ray, for example.
Right.
So anyway, there you
go.
Which
means you also need a beefy internet connection.
You do. I did okay on my, and I connected through Wi-Fi. I mean, the thing that was cool about this is I mounted to the wall, which was difficult in an old country house because the wall doesn't have a lot of thickness. It's built wrong. But, you know, I know how to do that kind of stuff. And then I got the TV up and mounted my big swivel. And then I plugged it in with power, the only thing I did to the back of it. And then I connected to my Wi-Fi. I turned on my Netflix account. I logged in with my YouTube account. And that's my only sources of feed. Actually, I think I set up Hulu too.
Do you live up in the mountains? Do you get your internet from satellite, or do you get have a direct feed somewhere?
No, not really. I don't think satellite's the best option for really good data, and mostly for gaming for latency. There's a problem
really
with satellite.
Low, yeah,
light isn't actually as fast as we'd like. Yeah. But no, I have Comcast.
I hate
Comcast with a passion, but I do have Comcast.
Yes.
I have been tempted to do a direct feed to a hillside across the mountains, but I have to take out a redwood tree or two to do that, and I just haven't gotten around to killing that tree. All right, so there you go. There's a little bit of update of tech stuff, and I'll post on the website at geekspeak.org with the model that I actually got. If you're curious, we can chat more about that and such. Okay, for Christmas Day, hacking occurred. Yes?
Yes. So this is an interesting story. So for Christmas, I bought myself and my fiance a PlayStation 4.
We got tech gifts this week, or this for Christmas for ourselves, right?
Yes,
television,
yes, PlayStation 4. And this is a funny thing. Like, I actually, until last year, I hadn't owned a television for probably as long as you
have. Yeah.
And as an adult, I have never owned a console.
Yeah, me neither.
So as a child, I had one. We had, you know, whatever, an Odyssey and a Nintendo at one point or another, you know, so, but I've never owned a console. So I thought it was time.
Okay, why did you choose a PlayStation 4? Because the Xbox has the Kinect, and you can dance in front of it, and that's freaking awesome.
Well, yeah, the Kinect is awesome, but what I was more interested was in indie games. And for some reason, while both Xbox and PlayStation, or Sony, have said they support indie games and have tried to put support out for there seems to be more indie games
on the PlayStation
becoming available or will be coming available by on PlayStation 4.
Okay.
And I looked at the games that are coming up, and the ones that I was most interested were there. There are a few on the Xbox.
Got a couple examples of indie games that you're
interested
in?
The Witness?
Yeah. Why is it interesting?
The new game by Jonathan Blow. Jonathan Blow made Braid.
Yeah, I heard Braid is great. I've seen video of Braid, and I want to play it. This is the one where you're walking through the desert, right? No, Braid. I'm sorry, the time one.
The Journey. Braid looks like sort of an old-style Nintendo side-scrolling game, but you can control time.
Right.
So the new game by him looks really beautiful from the images, and you know, I mostly have seen screenshots and a little bit of video of it. It's supposed to be out early next year. There's several others. I'm misremembering which ones were on Xbox and which ones were on PS4.
Right. I think that Journey's on, maybe Journey's a few.
Journey's
the one through the desert, right? PS4, yeah.
And there's a new one coming out by them that, or maybe out already, that is supposed to be another type of those sort of meditative games.
Yeah, let me recommend Braid one more time, because Braid is kind of like Mario Brothers. It's a side swiping scroller, if you will. Right? Almost
always? Yeah, it's a side-swiping scroller.
And you jump around. It looks just like it has the interface like Mario, except that you can pause and rerun time. So if you make a mistake, you just back up and you do it again.
Right.
So it's more like it's a game, except that you can't really lose because you just keep practicing. It's this fun kind of interactive way of playing.
And what's even more interesting about it is that it's got a really compelling story.
Yeah.
It's probably got one of the best endings to a game I've seen.
Cool.
At least as far as those style of games.
That's another thing to note, is that it used to be that games just were, you know, went on forever, you know, trying to get to the end of Pac-Man or Donkey Kong. It just ended when the hardware stopped supporting them.
Or when it got so fast enough that you can't keep up with it anymore.
Right. People can finish those games. I mean, they can actually finish them, and then the hardware actually fails to use them, but because of memory space. But in any case, that used to be the termination of the game. It didn't have a termination. Now games have full story arcs and are compelling, like, narratives.
Yeah. Those are the more interesting games.
Yeah.
I tend to like those. Like games like Limbo also would be another game.
So you went ahead and broke down, got your first console, PlayStation 4. You plugged it in. Christmas Day, you went, let's play.
went to register it on PSN, PlayStation Network. Network is down. At first, I think maybe there's a problem with my network, so I start messing around with it. No problems there. Everything else can connect. So I look up on the PlayStation Network. It's offline.
Now, this is Sony, of course. Sony makes this game. So was it a problem with Sony?
Well, at first I thought, well, maybe, you know, they had a whole bunch of console sales where they were giving away a free game with it where you download from their network. So I thought, well, maybe they're getting hit really hard by all these people trying to download the game on Christmas, right? So why is it offline? You know, of course, the Sony network thing doesn't say anything about why. So I start scouring the net to see if there's any stories. And eventually I came across a forum feed that had a link to an article in the BBC that the Lizard Squad, a group called the Lizard Squad, had performed a distributed denial of service attack, they call it, or a DDoS attack, against both the Xbox network and the PlayStation network.
So both Microsoft and Sony were hit by this, and both the leading console games. Basically, if you got a new one, you couldn't register it. And since you can't register a new one, you can't do anything with it.
Well, in this case, right? I eventually figured out I could do something with it.
Oh, good, good, good.
But I couldn't do any of the online stuff at all. You know, and one of the things is I wanted to download that game.
You wanted to download the game? You're good. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
But, you know, fortunately, I had got another game with it, so I that was a disc,
right.
Blu-ray disc.
So discs are still important, is what you're saying.
But,
so a denial of service attack, that's a very common type of attack. You basically overwhelm the server with requests that are bogus, but cause a situation where the server can't respond fast enough to everybody, and therefore it's a server denial to everyone that wants to use the service. We've seen many ways of doing this. We understand weaknesses in protocols when it's easy to take advantage of the protocol to do this kind of thing. So a good example of that is older Cisco routers can actually perform denial of service attacks on any machine they want by using the time system protocol, and they can basically overwhelm a server. Now, there's a lot of those machines out there, so you have to patch them. We cover stories like this on GeekSpeak all the time. Do you know the details of this denial of service, how they performed it?
There's the Lizard Squad has published a thing saying what they did, although who knows if that's actually the truth.
Yeah.
But they claim to have rooted an undersea router used on transatlantic cables and used those to distribute the attack. So if that's true,
which it probably isn't,
but it's probably not. But you know, some there are lots of variations on this where you could have one person or even a very small group of people take over a large number of machines by taking over certain areas where they distribute these things. So you can say, okay, you know, let's replicate this 100 times or 1,000 times or 10,000 or 1,000,000 times. You know, it just depends.
Now, Northern correspondent Greg suggests that Lizard Squad is a fantastic name. and I agree. It's got a great name. Now, they also made a claim. Lizard Squad made a video claim posted that said that the reason why Anonymous wasn't doing this. Anonymous is another hacker collective or non-collective. I don't know what you describe it as, a moniker for movement, whatever. Saying that they would never do this because they're in leagues with the media industry or something. And Anonymous said, no, we're not. That's ridiculous. So there's like this little public video forum of these non-entities talking to each other.
Right.
I caught one of the videos. And they seem so much like a James Bond film video. You know,
right.
It's like confusing and anyway.
It harkens back to a lot of the cyberpunk stories from the 80s, actually, that have predicted this sort of thing.
Yeah, sure.
There was another part of this, too, that of course, the immediate first media reaction was, is this the same group that took down to PlayStation?
Probably not, actually.
That took out Sony recently, and it's not.
Right. In fact, it's different. I mean, it's probably different networks. I would assume that the actual network, the public network that would handle the PlayStation is not associated with the corporate network because you're offering a service to the public versus you're running your company, and they're different areas. But, you know, the same vulnerabilities could be taken effect. But also, these denial of services do not have – Sony and Microsoft don't have to have done anything wrong to make their networks not work anymore. That's the whole thing about a denial of service. You could have, let's imagine you have a storefront at some bagel shop, okay? And you're running a bagel shop and everything's great, you've got sales and everything, and then 6,000 people show up to ask you if they can use the bathroom. Just the process of you interacting with that 6,000 people means you can't do any sales.
Correct.
You're not going to make any money on them. You could say no to every single one of them, you can't use the bathroom, but no one would still come to the store. There'd be this giant line. No bagels would be sold that day. That's a denial of service attack. There's nothing you're doing wrong except not having millions of stores, right? The way to do this is to scale it up so that you can respond even faster. And doing that is expensive early on. And to be at the level of scale where you can't get an out of service is extremely difficult. And there's whole industries around it.
I mean, there's very few companies that can get around that. Amazon, Google, maybe. And they're only, you know, you can take them down in local areas, but you can't do it worldwide very easily. But something, you know, certain networks, other networks,
There's no way to protect them.
Yeah. Well, this story gets more interesting.
Okay.
Well, first off, Lizard Squad claims to have done this because they wanted to point out security holes in both Sony and Xbox networks.
It's not
they wanted to clean up security holes. I have no idea. They didn't claim what I could find didn't say what the security holes were.
Well, we know that Sony's had some security problems. So,
right. And a denial of service attack is not going to necessarily do that.
It doesn't do anything. It doesn't take advantage of security vulnerability, and it doesn't really do anything but take the network down. Yeah, anyway.
In terms of attacks, denial of service is a fairly easy thing to do.
What was their second claim? Or you said it was the first claim was that the vulnerabilities.
Oh no, that was the main one that I knew of. But there's a second interesting component to it. So Kim.com.
Yes.
So this that's a whole story in itself.
Kim.com is this crazy guy, but we won't get into it. But go on.
Yeah. So he has this new service called Mega Privacy, mm-hmm. which is supposed to replace his Mega Upload site, which was taken down by the FBI, probably illegally. Who knows? But that's another story. he's this multimillionaire guy from New Zealand. He has an Xbox and wants to play Destiny on the Xbox on Christmas Day and can't because the Xbox network has been taken down.
So Destiny's available on Xbox and PlayStation 4?
I think it just is newly available on Xbox.
My son wants PlayStation 4 because he wants to play that game. So it's good to know.
But PS4 had it first.
All right,
so he wants to play it and can't. So he contacts through his Twitter feed, I'm not sure, but somehow contacts the Lizard Squad and offers them every member of Lizard Squad would get the benefit of a free Mega Premium account for life if they stop attacking the Xbox Live and PS networks and they never do it again. They have to never do it again.
Okay.
And
Did it work?
It worked.
For Xbox?
For both. It worked. So they stopped the attack so they could get free lifetime service on the Mega Privacy site.
That's horrible and wonderful at the same time. So that means that Kim.com, I can't say his name, knows who those people were.
Well,
because they signed up for new accounts, they gave him a free account.
Now he knows who they are. Knows who they are. But then his privacy site is
that's the whole point of it.
It's the whole point of it. Yeah. So you don't, you know.
That's fantastic. I didn't know that part of the story. Wonderful.
Yeah. So that ended the attack sometime late in the evening.
Yeah. On Christmas.
The Xbox network came back up pretty quick. The PlayStation network, as of this morning, was still down.
Yeah. Well, one of the really troublesome things about a denial of service is it can actually happen. You can produce it accidentally on yourself. So if you imagine all the PlayStations of the world haven't been connected for 24 hours, right?
Correct.
So every one of them is trying to connect to say, hello, I'm still here. And that can actually be a type of denial of service. So Sony might be the ramifications of this might go on longer because of the way their system is set up, and we don't know the details, of course. But
my speculation on this would be that they had failovers. So that each machine is trying to come up and take up that load, and then the machines start going down one by one, and each machine is still trying to distribute that load across, and they just keep going down.
As programmers, we know the problem they're in right now. Yeah. And, of course, Microsoft's been working for a long time to produce a competitive to Amazon's service called Azure, which is a hosting provider service, which means Microsoft does have a scale that's unprecedented. Not unprecedented, but there's a few companies out there that can kind of have that kind of scale, and Microsoft probably has that advantage. That's probably why they're ahead of the game from Sony.
That's most likely, yes.
Yeah. All right, cool. We are running late on Geekspeak. We'll be right back. We'll talk more about how your reward systems in your brain works and maybe a little bit about court appeals with Google in just a minute. Stay with us here on Geekspeak. You're listening to Geekspeak. My name's Lyle Troxell. In the air and with me is Phoenix Taves. Phoenix, hi.
Hi.
You know, on Geekspeak, Christmas in quarantine, practicing medicine in a spacesuit, and other tales from the Ebola hot zone. KOSP's Robert Pauly talks to Davis Perkins, a medical relief worker who's just returned from treating Ebola patients in a remote field hospital in Libya. And that is tomorrow on KOSP on the 7th Avenue Project. here in, on KOSP. Phoenix and I are talking about the geek news of the week, and we're going to continue to do so. I want to mention to you that recently, a California Court of Appeals ruled against Google, kind of. Actually, against email privacy in some ways. And basically, the case was that there was discussion about when a user can say to an ISP or an email provider, yes, go ahead and release that email to the courts because of a subpoena or whatever. Now, subpoenas are very clear. A subpoena given to like Google will provide that Google will then respond with the email body. But if a subpoena to them directly is not given, but the individual in court is asked to get that data and then makes a request to Google, that's a slightly different pattern on how the transfer could occur. And the subpoena rules are very structural and laid out in different court cases and have a lot of history. This other one is a little more abstract. And Google was basically saying just because an individual user, let's say Phoenix is in the court and the court's rules, hey, Phoenix, you need to give us your email, a message from this day. And you say, well, I don't have that message. It's on Google services maybe somewhere. In fact, I deleted it. Then the court could say, well, please tell Google to give us that email. So you then ask Google, and Google says, no, because there's no subpoena, so why should we do that, right? And so the court ruling was basically, no, when a user asks you, Google, to provide that, you need to provide it. That was the ruling that actually occurred. So it's kind of a slight difference to the way we've been dealing with it in the past, and it's a little frustrating. But I don't think it's that bad. I think it kind of makes sense. I think most of the reason why Google wasn't doing it is it's expensive to do this kind of thing, to respond to these kind of court cases. So the other ruling, the second ruling, is that courts can compel account holders to retrieve deleted email stored in like a Gmail account. And basically that means that even if you had deleted it, you can then recreate it, if you will, or cover it through Google services. So that also is something that should be done. So that's the current appeals case. It basically makes email less private, and saying, oh, I just made a mistake, and deleting it does not actually hide it for eternity. In fact,
right, yeah. Well, Google keeps it forever, right? I mean,
yeah.
Sort of forever.
Forever in a term of, you know, email
length.
Until they
need the space.
Yeah. The court case, which I really love, the actual court brief is a PDF that you can read through and actually read the whole thing. I was trying to read all of it before the show, but didn't get through the whole thing. So that's why I'm kind of summarizing a bit about it. Okay, let's talk about stress, shall we? We're talking about the holidays. Stress occurs, right?
Yeah. Well, this one is interesting to me as a tech worker. You know, I'm often asked to do things that are well beyond, you know, the hours that any normal person would put into a project. You know, I've times when I've had 90-hour weeks where I'm
programming
away with the promise that later on, you know, I'll have all this free time and I can enjoy it, right? So this is stress makes us work harder for pleasurable rewards, but doesn't make us appreciate them more. And I found that interesting for lots of reasons. But here, I'm just going to read the text of it from, I got this from Boing Boing.
Okay.
Stress prompted chocolate lovers in an experiment to exert three times as much effort to smell chocolate than unstressed chocolate lovers. But both groups reported about the same level of enjoyment when they got a whiff of the pleasing aroma, according to the study published in APA's Journal of Experimental Psychology, Animal Learning and Cognition.
Okay, great, right. I imagine this, like, you get stressed people, you give them like a vial, you're like, can you smell the chocolate? And they try and they try and there's no chocolate smell in there. And how many times they try is debated on how stressed they are. Anyway, I love the idea of the study. Okay, so what do you conclude from this idea?
Well, there's lots of things that I think about on this. So, like, I think about the gambling reward system.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you're constantly working, getting more stress of your losing money. But at the same time, you're continually going for that reward. But the amount of reward you get is still the same as any other person who'd come in
yeah.
and just, you know, was there for 5 minutes. You know, it's,
right.
It's
well, does that denote kind of that when you're stressed, you need access to that pleasure more? I like the idea that you don't actually achieve more pleasure, but you try to achieve more pleasure. Like, that's kind of the idea of the stressed in that study. Yeah, interesting. And it is kind of like the gambling effect. But I thought that the gambling reward system, the people that they get actually less enjoyment from the reward.
Less enjoyment from it, yeah. So they talk about that in the a little bit in the blurb, but I don't have that right in front of me.
Sure.
But the other thing I was thinking about is just in the sort of American motto of work hard, play hard, right?
Sure.
You know, so supposedly, you know, working hard is supposed to make that play hard be so much more enjoyable.
Right.
But in this study is suggesting that actually that's not true.
You want it more. You need the time off more. You're stressed about it. You keep on trying to get more play time.
Right.
You don't. And then when you finally do, you're enjoying it just as much as if you'd never been stressed in the first place.
Right.
So are you going to change your habits then and not do 90-hour weeks of programming?
I've been trying to do that. I've already been trying to pull that down for the whole
time. And Phoenix, is chocolate your reward? Is that the one that you really go for? I guess it's PlayStations.
PlayStations are good. I actually enjoy traveling more.
Yeah.
That's
funny, because traveling's stressful, or can be.
It can be, but I have an amazing fiance who likes to travel too, and we have a good time together.
Traveling with your partner is definitely better than traveling by yourself. I concur completely. All right, so stress makes us work harder for pleasure rewards, but doesn't make them bitter.
Doesn't make them better.
All right, so let's talk about the holiday season. Amazon has released a little bit of numbers about what they did for the holiday season, how much sales. And, of course, Amazon's probably the place where most sales in one location occurred. And so a little bit interesting story. First off, this article unfortunately reads too much like an advertising for Amazon, because the quotes that Jeff Bezos, the CEO, does are very much like, we're awesome and you can participate, you know. And that's what a CEO is supposed to do. So I'll give a little bit of lax to that. But in a company response to what happened the last few weeks, one of the things that happened is that 10 million people signed up for a new Prime account. Now, Prime is this service. I'm not endorsing it. I'm not saying that you should get it or anything like that. It's got some benefits. But basically, you pay an annual fee, and then you get benefits based off of that. And that annual fee, of course, is like money in the bank for Amazon, right? So they collect the fee up front, and then hopefully you get enough reward for that fee. And the things you get, mostly people know, is what's the main thing you get from Amazon Prime?
Well, you get free shipping.
Free two-day shipping.
And you get access to their premium movie service.
So, right, their movie service, that a whole bunch of titles are available for free if you're at Amazon Prime.
Sort of like Netflix.
The other thing, I didn't even know this, there's 700,000 books you can borrow. Excuse me.
Oh, yeah.
Do you know
that? That's a new thing from last 6 months ago.
Yeah, I didn't know that. So anyway, this season they shipped to more than 185 countries, Amazon did, which is kind of amazing. And then he goes on to this whole thing about how awesome Amazon Prime is, like, total salesy crap. You can listen to songs on that, I guess, as well, and TV episodes and so on. So the thing that I found is interesting, that the Fire TV Stick, which is a piece of hardware that Amazon sells, it's like the Chrome Cast. Mm-hmm. It's a small device you attach to your television, and then you can send data to it. And specifically, you can send all the data that you get through the Amazon services, right? You can watch movies and play music and watch television on it. And it's the greatest selling Amazon device ever. That's not saying a lot. It kind of is. It's cheap. It's the price point's lower. But Amazon makes like four things, right? They make all the tablets, and they make this thing.
So is this thing sort of like a Roku or an Apple TV box,
right,
or something
like
that?
Okay, Roku, Apple TV, Chromecast, and Amazon Fire Stick are the main devices, right, that are like this. They're small devices that go with your TV. The smart TVs that you get actually have these features normally built in.
Right.
So the one I just got, I didn't need one of these sticks that just built in. The other thing and it's only, it's less than $50. That's why the price point's such. But also to say that it's they really hammer the sale of these things, right? Amazon, everyone goes to Amazon to buy stuff, and the ads you see are for their devices, right? The tablets, the Fire Stick are definitely things that are up in front of people. They also said that Chromebook sold better than any other laptop. Second year in a row, oversold Microsoft laptops. Chromebook is the third operating system of popularity. There's four operating systems, basically. There's Linux, which is a multitude of them. And there's Microsoft, Apple's Macintosh OS, and then, of course, Chromebooks, which are a Linux derivative. And they kind of are the browser, the Chrome browser, in one piece of hardware. It's kind of cool. They're being used in schools a lot now, too.
Very inexpensive hardware, though, right?
Inexpensive hardware, and they're different on most computers that normally, traditionally, a computer has a hard drive and all the data is on the hard drive. The Chromebook really represents a copy of your Google experience.
It's a network computer.
Yeah.
It's harking back to the 1970s,
the
1980s,
decks.
when we used to, if you wanted to have, access to a mainframe, you had a terminal.
Yep.
Mainframe. The terminal had a little bit of stuff on it, but not much, and the mainframe did everything.
Yeah.
Except this is a little bit, slightly bit different, because it's got a little bit on the machine itself.
Yeah, but it's, and it, most people, I think this, a Chromebook's a perfect laptop for somebody to have, right? You can do all your writing and your emailing and your browsing and your viewing and your listening stuff on it, no problem. But if you want to like edit video on it, it's the wrong type of device. It just is not going to have the kind of scale you'd need for large crunching.
It looks like the thing, something that kind of bridges right slightly between the laptop and maybe a tablet.
Yeah. So Chromebooks outsold, definitely a large device. Samsung's 1080p televisions sold crazy amounts. The Fire tablets, which is their own tablet, sold really well. And, of course, all of those things were highly discounted for the holiday season. But the thing that I found was really interesting is that 60% of Amazon sales came from mobile devices. So more than 50% came from the phones and the tablets. And wow. It's true. I think I did some purchasing on that. I normally kind of do research on my device, on my phone, mobile devices, and then I go to a laptop to actually do purchasing because my password management system is that way. But 60% on mobile is kind of impressive. So there you go.
When back to that PS4 thing.
Yeah.
Amazon had published that they were going to be selling these things, the PS4 with a special deal, but they didn't say what the date was. And I happened to be on there at one point, and they accidentally, and I'm putting quotation marks around this,
I think it was intentional,
put the date of the sale when it would go on sale, and then it disappeared. You know, uh-huh. So it's like it clearly is like sort of viral advertising thing.
Yeah.
So I was
a mistake.
So I was online on Thanksgiving Day at the exact moment when they went on there, so I could get it.
Oh, and you got it. So you got a good discount.
So I got a good
for a device that didn't work on Christmas Day.
Correct. Yes, exactly.
Okay, so let's talk about the year in review by Facebook. Yeah?
Yes. So if you've been on Facebook, like everybody, in the last, say, week or so, there's been this year in review thing popping up on people's feeds.
I got it last year. I haven't seen it this year. I haven't been on Facebook much. But I got one on Google. So Google,
okay.
Google Plus did a year in review for photographs, and it was like a video montage. Pretty
right.
cool. I mean, automatically generated, right? I didn't do
it. Yeah, and on the surface of it, it looks really cool. On mine, it's great. It's got a picture of me and my fiance, and you know, we got engaged this year. So, you know, for me, I looked at it, and I'm like, oh, that's kind of cool.
Did you share it?
I didn't try.
Yeah, okay.
So maybe you can. I'm seeing everyone else's on my feed, too.
Yeah.
And it's something you can't, you can opt out of, although it's kind of obscure how you opt out, but you don't opt in. It's just automatically done for you, algorithmically.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this article that I found, and it was titled "Inadvertent Algorithmic Cruelty." And so this all sounds great when you're thinking about your life. If your year has been good, you're going to look back and this is going to look good. But what happens if something tragic has happened?
Oh, God, no.
And so this blog post by a guy named Eric Meyer, his daughter
Eric
died.
Eric Meyer, the JavaScript programmer? Go on.
I found it on Boing Boing, I don't know who, I don't know him specifically. But his daughter died last year. And, of course, his feed is showing up with this very happy-looking thing about the year in review, and it's got this picture of his daughter in there, and it becomes this thing where, because there's no person involved with this, there's no person who says, oh yeah, this actually is probably a good thing for them to see, this starts popping up on somebody's feed, and they re-see the pain and re-feel the pain of that event.
Oh gosh, I'm reading this, and of course the photo that the advertisement, if you will, for Facebook is a picture of his daughter in a circle and a dancing party around her, like an animated dancing party. I mean, a cartoonish dancing party around it. And
right.
That's what he sees one day in December. And of course, his daughter passed away, who knows how long ago, but let's say it was March. And of course, the grieving his life has changed, of course, horribly in numerous ways.
Right.
But the idea that, okay, now it's the holiday season. Here, let's remind you about this. Like,
right.
What
right
a horrible
at the,
experience.
Right at the horrible experience. I found it very, very poignant. And one of the things that comes up for me is this motto of the industry, which certainly Facebook embraces quite stridently, which is this disruption motto, which is to say that, you know, we can put this stuff out there, experiment with it, look at kind of one side of it, oh yeah, the good part of this, and ignore the possibility of these other things that could happen, and then eventually, if something bad happens, apologizing for it and say, oh, we're sorry. And, you know, it actually brings up this question of, you know, what point do we begin discussion of what we want and what is appropriate in our online communities and with the technologies we use?
Yeah.
So, you know, and, especially when something like this comes up, that's, you know, it's a little note that I wrote for myself here on this is technological progress is not inevitable. It is the result of human directed policies and decisions. That's not, you know, when we have an algorithm determining these things, of course, these are human created algorithms, but they can make mistakes.
Yeah. It's a shame because, of course, a human could do that too, right? A human could
Absolutely.
Have made the same mistake and not known Eric and his story well enough if someone had participated. But most likely, in traditional forms, if somebody's made a gift of like a photo album for you, they would completely understand the context of where that came from, right?
Correct, yes.
Computers don't understand context in that sense. Now, of course, the engineers at Facebook could go, okay, let's figure out how to do this. If there was a lot of grief in the year for the person, like they see a lot of stories of grief or condolences, then let's not provide this year-in-review concept to the person. You could definitely start trying to protect against it. But of course, we're going to run into the states where computers are trying to determine what works for us, and they're going to fail miserably like this all the time.
All the time. Well, because you lose that human context.
Eric Meyer is the developer programmer, CSS and okay. JavaScript expert that I'm aware of. So it's interesting that somebody actually know. I feel like at one point we interviewed him on GeekSpeak, but I can't find that source, so I won't claim that. Hey, you're listening to GeekSpeak. I'm Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Eric Taves. We're talking about
Phoenix Taves.
What's that?
Phoenix.
Sorry. We'll get into that some other time. All right. And stay with us here on GeekSpeak. You're listening to GeekSpeak. Let's talk about, you just talked about algorithmic processes to try to tell stories for human beings. And so that was a great story, Phoenix. And I just reminded me of this story about house number detection. So Google drives these cars around, and they drive the cars around so they can produce this feature called Street View, which is basically an ability for their maps to be extended by an actual representation of what it would be like to be on that street photographically. And of course, what the information on maps, one of the things that's actually tricky to get is what house is at what address? Like, where is the address on the street? You know that the street, 2 miles long of street, has a whole bunch of addresses on it because it's easy to determine that from postal records of sorts. But to actually to know which house is where is tricky. Mm-hmm. And so for years, Google's been taking the video footage and trying to find numbers that might be addresses and then calculating what the address actually is and then better having maps better represent where houses are. So you're not a block off or whatever. Of course, it can be actually more drastic than that too because sometimes addresses are wonky because of
right.
local scenes. So they have actually kind of perfected, in a way, the algorithmic detection of these numbers and processing, the OCR, optical character recognition of address numbers, most likely by slowly training the process over time by having a human approve. Now it has a 91% accuracy. It's better than humans at finding street address numbers, so which is kind of cool. It kind of makes sense, too, because every time you're driving down a street and you're looking for numbers, you're driving and looking, which is a bad thing to do
right.
when you're focusing on the sides, you know? So anyway, it just talks this article, which I'll link to up on geekspeak.org. 90%
huh?
of the time. It was the team's goal. And they're doing it 90% of the time. So it's pretty impressive what they're actually achieving. And some quotes, worldwide, we automatically detect and transcribe close to 100 million physical street addresses at a human level operator accuracy.
Uh-huh.
So, 100 million physical street addresses. Pretty cool.
That's hard enough for humans to do.
Yeah.
The number of times I'm looking for an address and there's just nothing there.
Here's a quote. We can transcribe the views we have of a street numbers in France in less than an hour using Google infrastructure, they say. That means all the photos that they have of France streets, they can do that in an hour, process and get all the addresses back. Anyway, pretty cool little story about achieving this. They don't talk about the algorithms, but I'm sure they'll be selling a service that has that ability at relatively soon.
I wonder how much of that's interpolation, too, between two different numbers. If you find one that's missing,
yeah,
what do you do?
That's interesting, of course, is that you get a lot of feedback from the system. You know the street. You know the
right.
range. You start getting the easy ones, and then the harder ones might be between two, and therefore, well, let's guess that this one's really blurry, or someone has, like, a cat. Six cats that are kind of look like numbers. The addresses can be anything. That's the thing that's so interesting is that people have personality when it comes to addresses.
Right,
so.
Right.
Pretty cool. And I like the article too. It has some snapshots of different types of addresses that they can actually detect. You know, where there's like partially obscured E is in the end of it, right? Because it's a number. It's the apartment number of
right.
the address, something like that. Yeah. All right. Anyway. So let's talk about NASA, shall we?
Oh, yes. This is something where I I was surprised that it took so long for this to happen. But the headline is NASA emails a socket wrench to the ISS, International Space Station.
What? How do you email something like that?
Well, as it happens, this past summer they sent up a
3D printer.
3D printer, and with of course whatever material they need to use to print stuff with, so they needed a ratcheting socket wrench for something that was going on. Maybe they were missing it one or it had broken, or they just wanted to test the system out. I don't know, but they designed the socketing wrench on the ground, tested it out, and then when it was ready, they sent it through the network up to the space station, and the space station printed out their new socketing wrench.
Awesome.
Took them 4 hours to do.
Yeah.
It's an interesting thing because, you know, at that point, all you need is the raw material.
Yeah.
Rather than having to send up the specific device, because
right.
You don't know.
Like, or every socket wrench on the planet. Right,
right, yeah. Something could break or get lost, you know, any number of things.
It's interesting to know that, it's true that something could have gotten lost or broken. It's interesting, though, that at some point in our space activity, we had everything itemized. Like, you knew every type of wrench you needed because every bolt was itemized. Like, there was no way to go, but I need a 3/16.
Right.
No, you don't, because there's not a nut up there that's that size. But now, you know, the International Space Station's big.
Yes.
And it's getting bigger. And there's a lot of people involved up there.
A lot of countries.
Yeah. Getting things lost there is totally feasible, right?
Yes.
And breaking something, but also having new piece of equipment that was never thought to need maintenance. It went up there. It happened to have different size things. Makes sense. You'd want to be able to build stuff. So definitely a cool thing. What kind of – I really want to know the 3D printer they had and what kind of material. If it was ABS plastic, because making a wrench with ABS – that's the common material.
Right.
And ABS plastic is not the best sort for a wrench. I mean, it's not – the walls are not – the material is not strong enough necessarily to be a wrench material.
I don't know what material.
Yeah, we don't
specifically,
know the details,
but I do know that the printer itself was specially designed for the space station, because you also have a problem of having no gravity up there too, and relying on any sort of gravitational field to print something with isn't going to work as well. So you can't, you know, a powder printer is going to have some problems up there for the simple fact that when you blow the powder out, where is it going to go?
Yeah.
So you have to have special systems to deal with that, if that is the type that it is. I'm not sure what kind it is.
Okay, here's a little – thank you very much for that story. That's about NASA emailing a socket wrench to the International Space Station. By the way, I saw this great size chart on all spacecraft, all things that we've launched from the planet. Well, not all of them, but a lot of percentages of them. The lift capacity, the amount of volume they had, like all that. International Space Station is massive when it comes to space. Right?
Uh-huh.
Biggest thing we put up. It's really cool. Anyway. All right. The Institute of Neuroinformatics at the University of Zurich has released a study where they took smartphone users and actually just phone users, so BlackBerry phone users and smartphone users. And BlackBerry and smartphone, the difference of them really is the BlackBerry has a keyboard, and the smartphones, what we call smartphones now, just have a touch surface. And what they found is that they scanned people's brain regions when they use the devices. And they found that the use of the smartphone is correlating to more brain activity around thumb use. So, you know, if you take a look at a professional athlete that does a specific skill and they hone that skill over, let's take a ballerina, for example, mm-hmm. and they hone this ability over and over and over again, they actually strengthen the ability of the brain to process things of that nature, to understand dance, to understand music, like all those things. Repetition causes you to be an expert in that area.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of 10,000 hours of activity on something really makes your brain different. So our brains are being different because we have devices that we use our thumbs a lot on. What's interesting is that they found a higher correlation for the brain activity to connection to the thumbs with devices that are not tactile but are visual. And that's the smartphone, right? So the smartphone, you actually, most of the time to use it, you have to either look at the screen or your thumbs have to be even better at memorizing location. In the button situation, your thumb can rely on the sensitivity of where the button is.
Right.
And so you can kind of have your buttons slide around the surface, knowing where they are in an easier way rather than the exact location. So that might be the reason why we have to have more brain activity assigned to our thumbs, if you will. And if you think of it as limited resources, it might be a bad thing. So that we can directionally put the thumb exactly on the key spot we'd want on a smartphone. So that's the kind of brain changing. Yeah, you're going
to say? I was to say that sort of tactility is what do they call it? What, a haptic response?
Haptic response, right. Which allows for a feedback system in your brain, which means you don't have to put as much resources to it. And anybody that's done any robot building capabilities or any kind of system that has a little bit of learning in it, if you produce an algorithm that self-corrects, you can be sloppy because the algorithm will modify it, right? So the haptic response system is a self-correcting algorithm that we have built in. We reach down for something, we kind of feel it with our pinky, we slide our hand over to exactly where it is, and we touch it. It makes grabbing things easier, right?
Yes.
If you have to be exactly precise, like a robot normally has to do, you have to do a lot of calculations to figure out exactly where that goes. So when we have no haptic response, brain has to take over. Now, this is my summary of their study. They're just, you know, they're good scientists. They're just saying, hey, look, more brain activity assigned to thumbs when you have a touch surface versus a thing with buttons.
It reminds me of there's a company that has invented a overlay screen for mobile devices.
Yeah, that gives haptic feedback.
It's a fluid filled thing. So right. it has these little, I guess,
nodulars or something.
Nodulars or something that you can fill them up. Algorithm you can use a programmatically.
Right.
Fill them up. So
you get it, Sesh. A couple weeks ago, we talked about a sonic system that basically did ultrasonic and then produced little bursts of pressure, wave pressure in air to get haptic response. So we'll definitely have systems that have better ability to give us the feedback that we're used to as human beings. But right now, look at your screen, really control your thumbs. You're defining more power associated with that activity. All right. Let's talk about the cosmos. This is this is something we don't know a lot about. We learn everything more and more about the cosmos all the time. But what do we surmise about the cosmos and life?
Well, this comes from a researcher at, and I did not write it down.
That's okay. That's why we have. That's why we have geekspeak.org. We'll have the article
at somewhere. Who has suggested that the dominant life form in the cosmos is probably super intelligent robots.
Yes, I love this story. If you want to call it a life form.
So here's the quote. As soon as a civilization invents radio, they're within 50 years of computers, then probably only another 50 to 100 years from inventing artificial intelligence.
Okay, hang on a second. First off, that whole statement is a case study of one.
Exactly.
Right? Like, the only ones we know about are humans, so maybe radio is really, really hard and artificial intelligence is easy. We don't know.
Right. Well, of course, this is the immediate problem I have with this.
Go on. I'm sorry.
That's science fiction here.
Sure.
But at that point, soft, squishy brains become an outdated model, it says. You know, so the suggestion is that at a certain point, following the model of human history, that, you know, we will begin to modify ourselves and then eventually create, you know, robots,
right?
Or, you know,
Roombas for the space
Roombas,
system.
Yeah, exactly. You know, that are, you know, extensions of ourselves,
right.
Future extensions of ourselves. Now,
a great example of this is, like, we've talked about landing on an asteroid. There's always discussion about maybe mining asteroids. Well, it's not going to be people that do that. It's going to be robots.
Right.
And these robots are going to have to be able to correct themselves, probably reproduce themselves, like an infrastructure to be actually mined asteroids, which maybe every space, you know, faring race might want to do, would really require a pretty complicated artificial robot system, right? And if something tragic were to happen to the planet, those things would be okay because they're out in space.
Right.
So most likely the idea being here that if you're going to produce a self-replicating thing that kind of has an ability, those are probably prominent in the universe.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
Well, cool.
and you know, there's on the one level, you know, my first reading of this is that that's really going out on a limb because we have a case study of one.
Yeah.
We don't have another alien race to look at.
But it's a good story, Phoenix. It's a good story.
It's a good story. You know, sure. Sci-fi is, you know, I love sci-fi.
Yeah.
But of course, this is an extension of the Ray Kurzweil singularity theory, which is the idea that eventually, everything is going to converge to this point. That's technology is going to become more and more rapidly developed. Things will become faster, and eventually it'll merge with us.
Yeah, we're talking about the Matrix. We're talking about Terminator. There's the worst case scenarios of that storyline, but where the machines get smart and decide they want to kill us. There are a lot of wonderful stories in that realm.
But, there is. Yes.
All right, one more kind of futuristic fun thing. And the best thing about this article is they didn't label it "scientists create Harry Potter's invisibility cloak." Every time there's some kind of cloaking or invisibility type science thing, they always pull up
Harry Potter.
Yeah, Harry Potter. Or any, you know, competitor.
Lord of the Rings.
Yeah. So this is from the Business Standard. It's an article about a new metasurface coating. Now, okay. So standard lithography, which we use for creating circuit boards. This is the idea of you make a – it's a silkscreen process, right? You make a mask of material, and it has holes and shapes in it, and then you shine light through it, causing a shadow to be produced on the substrate, and then you – that bleaches or modifies some chemical, and then you can etch the material, and then the output is a highly detailed physical structure in material. Okay, that's lithography. And we do that for circuit boards. We're really, really good at that, actually. The reason why computer chips, excuse me, not just circuit boards, but computer chips as well, the reason why we can fit so many transistors, this astronomical amount, millions and millions of transistors on a chip, is because of really good lithography practices. Right. So we're good at controlling these images. So this new meta surface, this coating process, is the cutting and creating of a copper lithography wrap for a physical object in 3D space. So it's a flat thing you put on something else. And the reason this is interesting is that when we detect something from a distance, if you wanted to, for example, scan and pick up with radar or other high-frequency scanning capabilities some object, the way that happens is it has a reflective quality that is because of the material itself. Just like the reason why we see color, its reflective quality has the characteristic to remove all of the colors except for the one that's being reflected. That's why you see it. This thing allows them to modify the shape with this coat so that it doesn't look like metal. It looks like something else. It's a very cool process.
Interesting.
You can learn about it up at geekspeak.org. Obviously, with the music in the background, you can tell that we're running out of time here on Geekspeak. So I'll close out the show. But everything we talked about up on Geekspeak, including extra stories we didn't get to, up at geekspeak.org. Geekspeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. A Geekspeak is a Creative Commons Attribution 3.0, which means you can use our stuff any way you'd like, reuse it, recut it, anything you'd like, as long as you let them know that we say hi. Give us some attribution for that. This is Public Radio for the Central Coast, 88.9 KUSP, Santa Cruz. We are online at kusp.org. To find out more about any episode of Geekspeak, including this one, visit geekspeak.org. Today's theme song was by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music. Our intern today is Chandler. Thank you so much, Chandler, for being with us. And I'm Lyle Troxell, and the air with me was Phoenix. Phoenix, we'll see you next time, and see you next week.
Thank you, Lyle.